Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Of all the books on a new parent's shelf, several are probably about infant sleep. And one of those is probably Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems by Dr. Richard Ferber.
Dr. Ferber calls his method progressive waiting. Popular culture calls it crying it out. The book became so popular and controversial that, much to the doctor's chagrin, his method may be best known as Ferberizing your child.
Well, after decades serving as director of the Center for Pediatric Sleep Disorders at Children's Hospital in Boston, Ferber is retiring this summer. He's here to talk with us about the science of infant sleep, warring views about nighttime parenting, and his long and distinguished career. Dr. Richard Ferber, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you.
And the doctor will be taking your questions, so give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Ferber, your name evokes songs of praise and also wails of criticism, and I want to get to that in just a little bit. But it's not often that we get a chance to talk to someone like you, so if we could just step back actually a little and begin with your own story. How did you get interested some 40 plus years ago in this issue of infants and how they sleep or don't sleep?
Well, I had finished my pediatric training, and I was doing a fellowship with a Dr. Peter Wolf here at Children's, and he had studied the development of states in children, including sleep, and he was interested in rhythms, which are so important in sleep. And on working with that, I learned a lot about sleep. There was a lot of research that had been done in sleep, even though nothing to actually help people clinically. And it was also, this was in the 70s, the sleep centers were starting to open for adults, and we were starting to see work coming out of these places about how to take care of people. And that's when I said, you know, there's a lot of problems in children. I knew this from my pediatric experience.
And your experience as a father?
And I knew it from having two young children. And we said, there's just nothing available. I think we should try to set up a program that follows what they were starting in adults and see what we can learn and if it is actually possible to help people.
Well, in those early days, before much of the research that we're now familiar with had been done, how did you get your own two children to sleep?
Well, my children were not the worst sleepers in the world.
Lucky you.
But I went through a lot of the same mistakes that I'm helping people with today. I would walk my child around, try to get him to sleep, not understanding habits that I was getting them into. I certainly didn't understand the crucial relation between the sleep schedule and the ability to sleep, and some of that information was not available back then. So I have some feeling from my own as well as working with so many families all these years.
Well, your book, Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems, was first published in 1985. And I love the story behind how that actually got, that happened, because apparently a fellow named Fred Hills, who was your editor at Simon & Schuster, when he got your book, he himself at that time actually had a young child and was trying to figure out how to get his child to sleep, and took your manuscript and pretty much followed it step by step and found that it worked for him, and the rest is history.
A new story to me.
Oh, really? That's according to the New York Times.
The Fred Hills part I know about, but the idea was put out there, and he liked the idea. And so way before there was anything down on paper, we started working with him.
I see.
So we did not have a book to send him to start working. And actually, we started working on it some years before it came out. So that's an interesting story.
Well, you'll have to take it up with the New York Times. So maybe they just decided to make it a little spicier than in truth. But the method that you describe in the book is interesting enough in and of itself. And for people who haven't read the book, it's pretty much in popular culture, as we mentioned earlier, been boiled down to cry it out. You let your child cry him or herself to sleep. That is I'll grant an extreme simplification. So why don't you describe to us what the Ferber technique of helping children learn how to sleep on their own is?
Well, not only is crying it out an oversimplification, it's actually quite a mistake, because one of the reasons that we wanted to take a look at this is we didn't believe in crying it out, and I still don't. And I think one of the more common scenarios that we deal with is people coming in to tell us that their child wakes up every night crying and they have to go tend to them in one way or another. But night after night after night, there is crying in one way or another, sometimes for very long periods of time. And this to us made no sense, and we felt we had to be a better way.
That the long periods of crying,
even
made no
short.
Sense?
I mean, even if it's a child who wakes up three times a night crying, and someone goes right to them and does something, whether it's feeds them, walks them around, switches beds, or whatever. It didn't make sense that had to be part of the night, night after night after night.
And so then what is it that you do suggest that parents do? What is the
Well, the first thing, and this is very, very important, there is no Ferber method, especially if you use a singular like that. That our approach is to start with an understanding of how sleep works. And then second, for an individual family, if things are not going wrong, what is not going wrong? And then once you have all of that, to try to design a change to move in the right direction. So one of the more common things we see is a situation where the only problem or the main problem is the child is not on a good sleep schedule. They may be going to bed too early, getting up too late, their nap may be too long, they may be taking too many naps, the schedule may be too variable. And no matter what else the family does, you're not going to be able to get the child mm-hmm. to sleep well. And fixing the schedule is just right at the top of the list.
But on the other hand, in your book, I mean, even in the revised edition of the book, there still is sort of a general guide for parents. And while I absolutely take what you're saying about how you have to look at the whole picture about what's happening at home, the child's personality even, parents... daytime parenting techniques, et cetera. I think the thing that people sort of all, you know, we all want answers. We all want to figure out what's the doctor's prescription. And you, I mean, you have coined this term called progressive waiting, I believe.
Right. But that's only one approach to one problem. I mean, if you, in terms of what is a general approach, the kinds of general guidelines, we find it's important, one, for the child to be on a good schedule, one that can work for them, because you can't get anywhere without that.
Throughout the day?
Oh, actually, throughout the day. And the body rhythms are exquisitely controlled, or should be, and need to be locked into place with regularity. Regarding some of the habits around sleep, we found it's very important that the way that the situation that is happening when the child falls asleep is the same situation that will be present throughout the night. There are no changes. There is no such thing as actually sleeping through the night, because sleep is a cyclic process. There's deep sleep, there's light sleep, there's dreaming, and there's a number of wakings during the night. Mm-hmm. And that means a number of times to go back to sleep during the night. Well, if you fall asleep in the living room with the television on and someone's arms being rocked, and then wake up in a quiet bedroom by yourself, it's hard to understand how anybody could fall back asleep any more than you could if you wake up in a different setting in the middle of the night when you wake up. But in fact, that's what many people are doing. They have the youngster fall asleep one way. The child wakes up a different way. The tables have been turned, which is really not fair to the child.
And this is what's popularly known as the sleep association.
Those are sleep associations, which we all have. We all learn to fall asleep a certain way. Heavy blanket, big pillow, quiet room, noise, whatever.
Now, Dr. Ferber, forgive me for interrupting, but I don't mean to actually press this point, except for the fact that, you know, as many of the listeners know, because I've mentioned it a couple of times, we have a little girl at home who's 11 months old now. So I, you know, just over the past year, I've been in the thick of all of this sort of daytime, nighttime parenting stuff, and lots of conversations in mom's circles, et cetera. And it gave me this sense, and I want to reflect that sense of what's out there in the popular culture, in what parents are thinking of and hear of and talk about with each other. And that is that part of what's in your book involves, you know, putting the child, while he or she is still awake, down in their crib or their bed or wherever they sleep, and then leaving the room. And if they complain a little, you come in a minute or two later, comfort them, leave, and you sort of come in another minute or two later, essentially to perhaps change those very associations we were talking about?
Well, right, but what you're talking about is one approach to one particular problem, and I really want to emphasize that, because that's just a small part of it. But if you have a situation where, let's say, we have a youngster who's crying repeatedly during the night, he's rocked to sleep at bedtime, then put into the crib. He doesn't even know he's put into the crib. Somebody sneaks him into the crib, sneaks out of the room. Then the child, every time he wakes, everything's different. They have to come in and replace those feelings, pick them up, rock them, rub their back, whatever they were doing. Well, for the child, that doesn't seem to be a very nice night. Mm-hmm. So either the family chooses one way where there are no changes, and that could be in their bed. We don't particularly care where a family chooses to have the youngster sleep, but it should be consistent. Obviously, they're not going to sit and rock somebody all night long. That would work, but they're not going to do that. So we work with the family to find out what it is they want.
Families who come into the center at Children's Hospital.
Right.
But what about for those families?
And the same thing. I would hope if they read our materials or went to any other pediatric sleep center, mm-hmm. They would first find out what it is the family wants. And if they want the child sleeping in their bed, that's fine. And you can still have all the same problems there. You can still have to, even if they're sleeping right next to you, you still may have to rub their back repeatedly during the night or feed them or even get up and walk around with them. Whatever it is, though, we want to have something consistent. And so the child falls asleep under the same conditions that are there when he or she wakes up.
Well, the reason why I am pressing this is because you are fully aware that your book it became so popular, especially after it came out in paperback. And I know you kind of take umbrage to this, but your name has been turned into a verb. I mean, in my mom's group that I went to, one of the first questions was, are you going to ferberize your child? And I think, granted, it's an oversimplification, but it goes straight to the heart to how you know, fraught and controversial these parenting techniques are, and especially as they rise in interest and fall, and then you have competing techniques, etc. So I want to get to that and sort of how your own understanding has evolved over the course of your long career. But before I do that, I want to welcome in some of our callers into the conversation. So listeners, you know who Dr. Richard Ferber is. He is retiring after four decades at Children's Hospital. What do you make of this verb, to ferberize? Did you do that to your child? Or do you think anything that involves even a little bit of crying may be harmful to children? And I also want to ask kind of a bigger question about the philosophies of infant sleep. Is there a generational divide, a cultural divide, or even a divide between science and intuition when it comes to what should be an enchanted world of rest? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. And Dr. Ferber, if you don't mind, we've got some callers already who would like to ask you a question or two. Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Berlin. Welcome to Radio Boston, Eric.
Hello.
What's your question, Eric?
So my wife and I have a wonderful daughter, 19-month-old daughter, Rain, and I'm a high school teacher, so we go to bed early at night, 8, and I get up at 4 in the morning, and we have a very regular schedule. But that being said, our daughter just doesn't sleep as well as we'd like, and we're sleep deprived, and we just are out of our minds and would love to figure out how to get her to sleep more, just sleep through the night more. She sleeps in bed with us. And whatever your thoughts are on that.
Well, Eric, so stick with us, and I'll just turn it over to Dr. Ferber.
Well,
diagnosis by radio is probably pretty difficult.
It can be. I don't know very much here at all. The fact that she sleeps in bed with you is not a problem if that's what you want, but you'd have to tell us what the problem is. Does she sleep from 8 to 4 like you do, and what's the rest of her sleep schedule, and what are the problems?
What's that?
Eric, I heard you might have a small distraction in the background.
Yeah, we do have a small distraction. So she nurses to sleep, and she needs to nurse to sleep, and I don't know if we can break that association or what.
And do you have to do that again in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
How many times?
Two or three times in the night.
Okay, so, I mean, there can be other problems going on here, but we can just address that one particular issue. Most children stop nursing or feeding during the night by around 5 months or so. So on a nutritional basis, she's way past that, and this just then becomes habit. But nursing throughout the night is one of the easiest ways at this age to just totally disrupt the sleep patterns. First of all, your child gets conditioned to actually get hungry during the night because these are feeding times. She gets used to falling asleep with a bottle or nursed, and so that becomes habit. All the milk that she takes in has to be processed, digested, which stimulates a series of hormonal and enzymatic responses throughout the body, and metabolism goes up and the body temperature goes up when it should be going down. So this isn't hard to stop, and there's lots of ways of doing it, but one of the easiest ways is not to just do it cold turkey, but see how close the feedings are during the night and just each night spread them out a little bit further, and it should be easy to stop over usually 1 to 2 weeks.
Eric, thank you so much for your call. I hope you found that helpful as a way to get started with your 19-month-old. Let's go to Attleboro, where Rebecca is calling. You're on the air, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling not with as much a question, just kind of to share some thoughts. We did co-sleeping with our son, feeding on demand, and, you know, I don't expect my little kid to sleep through the night, and I didn't really necessarily want it because I was, you know, for a couple reasons, because I was feeding on demand if he was hungry or if he, you know, needed some nourishment or even mommy time. I didn't mind nursing him. I mean, we'd fall asleep together nursing. Then, like, another reason was I did infant potty training. So many times my little one woke up because he had to use the bathroom. And that was something that I, you know, didn't mind either. And I just feel that, you know, the little baby doesn't necessarily, he knows his needs. Once he gets older, you know, my 18-month-old now, he's now sleeping through the night, and we're starting to train him to just to, you know, go down if we want him to go down. But especially as an infant, I think there are some needs that they have that we can meet. And by meeting them, our nights weren't stressful. Even though we were up, you know, if I nursed him, he'd go back to sleep, and it actually wasn't as bad as some people think it is.
Rebecca, thank you so much for your call, because Dr. Ferber, that brings up for me sort of this, the subtext to all of this is that I know that you can't deny that your book has been both extraordinarily popular amongst parents, and maybe its early edition was also somewhat controversial because there's the whole crying it out issue. But also that early book as well included references to some studies that said if children aren't taught how to put themselves to sleep, that they may end up grow up being quite dependent for a long period of time. Now, your 2006 revision, you know, basically took all that out of the book, but it sort of drives to the heart of the matter of, like, what is it that we're really trying to accomplish when whatever methods we might use, trying to teach children how to sleep? Is it for parental convenience? Is it for childhood development? Is it for something else entirely?
Well, I mean, at first, you keep coming back to crying it out, and we don't recommend crying it out. We've never recommended that, and I strongly feel against that. You may want to help a youngster cry less at night, but the goal is not to see how much they can cry at night. There's no purpose for that. Now, in terms of why do things, there's lots of reasons to do things at night. So sometimes even if the child is up and has to be rocked back to sleep four or five times a night, that may not be causing any great problem to the child as long as the parents can respond quickly. However, the parents may not be getting any sleep, and that if they are not getting sleep, they may not be able to go back to sleep as easily as the child does.
And that could have an effect on the whole family.
Well, a sleep-deprived parent is not going to be as good a parent.
There are many of them out there.
Right. And then second, to do the flip side, is that the way our body rhythms were set, that after the early months, sleep is supposed to coalesce at night, and it's not supposed to be fragmented. And so if it is fragmented too much, we do know that that has impact on all kinds of daily functions and is not really ultimately in the best interest. So in terms of Rebecca, if she had the youngster co-sleeping with her, that's fine. If she didn't mind nursing once during the night, that's fine. It's probably not going to cause a problem for anyone. But even if she were happy nursing six times a night, for the child to have to get up and nurse and deal with all that input six times a night probably would not be in that youngster's best interest.
Dr. Ferber, we've just got a minute or so to go with you. And honestly, not just out of my own personal interest, but we've had so much response even online to this that I know we could have a very long conversation with you, because what's more important actually than a parent's relationship with their child? But I just want to take it right back to you and your career in the last 60 seconds or so we have. You've been doing this for 40 years. You are basically the pioneer, I think it's safe to say, in pediatric sleep. Why step down now when there's so much more research out there that's done and the field seems to be that much more exciting than it was when you started?
There's a lot of other things I want to do, some of it in the field that I can't do in the situation that I've been at. And the second reason is when we started, we were really by ourselves. Now there are sleep centers for children all around the country, all around the world, in fact. There's an International Pediatric Sleep Association. There's national meetings. We're a main part of the main sleeps academy in the United States. So I feel like that part of the job has been put forward and will continue.
Well, we wish you all the best. That's Dr. Richard Ferber. He is author of Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems. He stepped down as the head of the Center for Pediatric Sleep Disorders at Children's Hospital in Boston in June. Dr. Ferber, thank you so much for joining us today. Well, listeners, before the break, I just want to say this to all the parents listening. It does get better, because that's what experienced parents told me after my daughter was born last summer. And I'll admit, for a long while, I was very dubious. But then about a month ago, all of a sudden, our daughter decided to give me and my husband the gift of an unbroken night's sleep. So just as a reminder to all the new parents again out there that it does get better, here's our nightly 90-minute routine compressed down to 90 seconds. Call it a little postcard from our enchanted bedtime.
Go on in. Oop, we have to wash your hair because you ground apples and squash into it again. Good girl. 1, 2, 3, rinse. All right, in the towel. Okay, I'll let you. We have to do your massage. Cutie pie, and put on a fresh diaper. Ow, don't bite. Look at the time, it's 7:30. Wow, almost lights out. Little nut brown hair, who was going to bed, held on tight to big nut brown hair's very long ears. Are you sitting on top of big nut brown hair? Uh-oh. Are we in the danger zone, sweetie pie? I see you yawning. Come on. Lights out.
Horsey, don't you stop. Just let your feet go. Clippity clop. Tail goes swish and the wheels go round. 8:30 off. I think she's asleep. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks.
Justin. We'll be right back.